travel back in time to the 80s, reliving the music.
Everybody, have fun tonight. Everybody, Wang Chung tonight.
The movies.
Yes! 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 Oh! Oh! Oh!
I'll have what she's having.
And the parties.
No one in my family ever drinks.
That's great. You probably never run out of ice your whole life.
Because just like you, we're stuck in the 80s.
Sure, it's not 1985 right now, but who knows what tomorrow will bring.
Hey, welcome to Stuck in the 80s. It's your old pal, Spearsy. And this week we talked to Emmy Award-winning actor A. Martinez about his amazing 50-year career from Santa Barbara in the 80s to his recent work on Longmire, Dark Winds, and Avatar, The Last Airbender.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, any time we spend together is quality time.
This episode of Stuck in the 80s is sponsored by The 80s Cruise. Join your Stuck in the 80s hosts along with MTV VJs Mark Goodman, Alan Hunter, and Downtown Julie Brown in spring 2025 for a week-long trip aboard the Royal Caribbean Explorer of the Seas. Performers will include Squeeze, Adam Ant, Christopher Cross, Sheila E., Men at Work, Andy Bell of Erasure, Wyatt Riot, Information Society, I'm Running Out of Air, Curtis Blow, Honeymoon Suite, The Alarm, and more. I got through it. Are you ready for the promo code? That's really why you're still listening, isn't it? For first-time guests on the 80s Cruise, use the promo code STUCK, that's STUCK, to get $200 in cabin credit. You have to be a first-time guest, and you need to use the promo when you book. Just point your favorite web browser to www.the80scruise.com for more information.
I was hoping that maybe we could talk.
Sure, let's talk.
Do you think we could go inside, maybe talk in private?
Oh, I've got a lot of valuable stuff in there, Katie. Stuff that could break if you were to take me by surprise again and start swinging. So I think whatever we have to say to each other, we can say it out here.
With us today is a special co-host. It's Melissa from the other side of the house.
Hello, Spearsy, all the way from the other side of the house.
Okay, so you might be asking yourself, why is my wife making her Stuck in the 80s debut this particular week? Here's the reason. Melissa is probably the biggest expert on A. Martinez that you will ever know. And A. Martinez is this week's interview guest. How did you first meet him?
I met him back in 1988 at the Daytime Emmy Awards. I was 14 years old. Jeez. The 80s, of course, were the golden age for daytime soaps. A was starring as Cruz Castillo on Santa Barbara at the time, which was his breakout role. He played Cruz for 7 years and almost 1,500 episodes, and he also won an Emmy Award for lead actor.
Every time you tell me an A. Martinez story, I always just shake my head in disbelief that you got to meet one of your heroes at such an early age. What was it like? I mean, what do you recall from that very first meeting? Were you composed? Were you calm? Did you ask him a question you'd been waiting to ask him?
I was the opposite of composed. I burst into tears and I had a little notepad and I wanted to ask him for an autograph, but I couldn't even find the words. And he just looked at me and said, "Would you like me to sign that?" I nodded, still not saying anything. And I don't know how I didn't almost pass out. And thankfully, much to A's credit, he didn't hold that lack of composure against me.
It's funny, folks. When I first visited Melissa in New York, where she was living at the time, and I go into her condo, and there's these photo collages in the office of her with A. Martinez. it was a little. It's a little intimidating to know. That your partner is, you know, such good friends with, you know, such a huge star, you know, in daytime TV in the 80s.
Well, I feel very fortunate and I can't believe I've known him now for 35 plus years and that I am older now than A was when we first met. That's very humbling.
God. Yeah. Oh, and if I can I toot your own horn for you?
Are we tooting now?
Behave. Melissa is also an author. Her book, Notes from a Single Gal in the City on Dating and Mating, was published in 2021. Tell us more about that.
Sure. It's actually an offshoot of the dating blog that I had long before we met called Single Gal in the City. As you mentioned, I published it in 2021 and I actually relaunched it recently with some additional content and a spiffy new cover. And it's all about the trials and tribulations of being single and what I would say is the toughest dating market in the country, long before you came along and swept me off my feet and away from New York, much to everyone there's astonishment.
Hey, just for the record, let me say it again. I offered to move to New York.
You offered to move. You could not have handled the winters there. You're a Florida guy. You couldn't even handle the winter when we were in Chicago for a weekend.
It was sleeting. It was a blizzard.
It wasn't a blizzard. There were just some sheets of ice. That's all.
They closed the airport. We had to come back a day later.
Yes, we did. But okay. That's what it's like in wintertime.
Okay. Okay. I guess. So let's pivot back to A for a second. I don't think that some people who listen to the show know just how many roles he had in the 80s.
Well, he's actually, he was in acting for 15 years before he landed Santa Barbara. And so now total of 50 plus years in the business, encompassing TV, film, and some theater roles too. He had guest appearances on so many of the popular shows of the 80s. Remington Steele, Heart to Heart, Falcon Crest, Fantasy Island, Chips, you name it, he was a guest star.
Wow. I remember being astonished that he worked with John Wayne in a movie called, it was called The Cowboys?
Yep. Mm-hmm. In the 1960s, that was his very first role as a teenager.
Yeah, that's got to be nuts. I think he and I talk about that during our interview.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't get any more legendary than John Wayne. So I can't imagine for him being a teenager what that was like to have as his first acting role.
So years, obviously, after working with John Wayne, A transitions to a romantic lead in Santa Barbara. What made Santa Barbara so different as a soap opera? I mean, I'm asking as someone who just wasn't a consumer of that type of TV show in the 80s.
I really think what set it apart was the writing. It had this offbeat comedic style that set it apart from other soaps. It actually won 26 Emmys out of 30 nominations, two of which were for writing. One of the main characters would quote Shakespeare. One of the main characters, who was a former nun, got killed by a giant neon letter sign. There was a cross-dressing mobster. So as much as you had some of the familiar tropes, you know, of soap operas, there was just a level of wit that was unlike anything in other daytime soaps.
And A was part of like a power couple.
Yes, yes. The legendary Cruz and Eden, who you've also seen a few clips of. one soap magazine described them as having enough chemistry to fuel a jet. And I think that's a really great way to put it, because they were that rare daytime couple that were just as interesting together as they were when they were being torn apart and finding they were back to each other. And they really just represented this ideal of a couple that loved each other to the ends of the earth, no matter what crazy obstacle the writers threw at them, some of which included Eden being thrown into a tank full of man-eating sharks. Cruz saved her from that, from the rooftop of a burning hotel, from an elevator that crashed down to the ground after a fire. So there were no shortage of dramatic situations that they were tossed into. And keep in mind, too, this was during the soap's heyday when, quote, super couples were being churned out left and right. This was the era of Luke and Laura, Bo and Hope. The website soaps.com actually ranked Cruz and Eden as number 4 on their list of the top 45 super couples of all time on the soaps.
Who was number 1?
I think it was probably Luke and Laura. But there's just an enduring magic about Cruz and Eden. And you see it all these years later on YouTube. There are multiple channels devoted to them, fan pages. There was something very special about the chemistry that Cruz and Eden and A had with Marcy Walker, who played Eden.
Well, as you're about to find out, I finally got to meet A in person back in November 2021 when he walked Melissa down the aisle at our wedding. Mm-hmm. Which was probably one of the more surreal moments of anybody's life.
Yep.
So A and I are going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to cover his love of Jackson Browne, our mutual love of Jackson Browne and his music and how his music inspires A's career. We're going to talk about his time on Santa Barbara. We'll talk about some amazing advice that was given to him early in his career. We will also touch on some of the other roles that he's worked on, including he's currently starring on Dark Winds. We talk about the movie Pow Wow Highway, and I want to talk about that more after the interview. But first, sit back and enjoy this interview with actor A. Martinez. A, welcome to the podcast.
Steve, thank you for having me, man. I'm happy to be here.
It's a long time in the making. Got to thank the wife for setting this up. But I have been seeing you all over the place lately. Last year in theaters for Michael Bay's Ambulance, Netflix, where I'm obsessed with Longmire. Now I'm getting obsessed with AMC's Dark Winds. Mm. And of course, we saw each other 2 years ago, almost to the day, where you walked my bride down the aisle at the wedding.
That was a great, great day, man. I got to get to be her surrogate father for that, and I loved it. It was, you know, I tell you, man, that was one of those days of the things you go through that just leaps out. I mean, not just because of what it meant for you guys, but just what it meant for me, and to be able to be there with Marilyn Hickson and her family, since Marilyn Hickson was among the people I met through Santa Barbara that actually became a friend of mine, as was the case with Melissa, your wife. And that's a real rare thing to have people, you meet people because of the work you do and have them turn into lifelong friends. That's not something that happens all that often. And I love it when it does. So it was a great day for me too, man.
It was surreal the night before. I remember we were sitting together at the rehearsal dinner, and we started talking about Jackson Browne. And so I wore my Jackson Browne t-shirt today, my concert t-shirt. So it's been late for the sky because I love how you always have these amazing stories about Jackson Browne, about, you know, your encounters with him and your near misses with him at times. And I just I'm always ready for a good A. Martinez Jackson Browne story. Well, I've been out walking. He was a big inspiration in your career. How did you first get into him?
I'll just say this. I was at a movie where a guy that I knew just peripherally, he was real good friends with a friend of mine. His name was Richard Baskin from the Baskin-Robbins family, and he'd briefly been the lover of Streisand, or maybe not that briefly, I don't know. But I see him in the lobby after the movie, and he goes, hey, man, you got to come to my mom's house right now. I go, what? Hey, Rich, good to see you. He goes, no, there's some music there that you got to hear, you know. And I'm going, well, cool. The thing is, I got plans, so I can't really do that tonight. But what are you talking about? He goes, no. Whatever you had planned tonight, you gotta change. You gotta come to my mom's house. And I go, real Rich, he goes, hey, and he looks at me, and I'm going, well, heck, you know, he needs me to go way more than I need not to go, apparently. So I canceled my plans and I drove to this apartment building on Wilshire Boulevard in Westwood. This one of the tallest buildings in the area. And his mom had a penthouse apartment in that place. And I went into this place. Turns out Rich didn't even show. But I got the address, knocked on the door, went in there. There's no furniture in the place. I don't know if she's leaving or coming. And there's all these people. I don't know any of them. And there's a little record player sitting on the corner on the floor with two little speakers. And there's Jackson's first record, that picture of him, you know, with his long hair. I guess it was, the idea of it was, Saturate Before Using It became called, because in the old days, the poor man's air conditioning was to like fill up with this canvas bag in your car, hang it on your window, and you could drive through Death Valley and survive. But so there it is. And I'm going, well, no one's playing or listening. So I just sit down and I put it on and I listen. I listen to the first side. I am instantly blown away. I flip it over. I listen to the backside. I flip it over again. Listen to the front side. I flip it over again. Listen to the backside. No one bothered me. No one seemed to care. But I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, this is folk music at its heart. You know, it rocks, but it's basically folk music, and it's not virtuoso stuff. And it's incredible art. And it was the beginning of me realizing, you know, you don't have to like feel bad about the fact that you didn't have expensive lessons and you didn't have like a cultural background that put you into the, you know, high echelons of the American musical theater. So to me, it was the beginning of actually believing I should keep at it. And I think because of that, you know, my whole family is musicians. I mean, Leslie and I met. One of the first things that I clocked was this woman can sing all of Joni Mitchell, and not only sing it, but nail it.
Wow. You know,
so we were chasing that kind of language, and all my kids are musicians, and you know, so Jackson.
Yeah. You released an album, right, in the 90s?
I did. Yeah, it's called Fragrance and Thorn, and Leslie sang on that record too, as did a lot of people. It was I had a boss on Santa Barbara, this woman, Jill Phelps, who was profoundly instrumental in freeing me and getting me started as an actor, you know, giving me a chance, putting me and Marcy together and putting us in the center of that show for a minute. And then it hooked. And then as we went about the early days of playing out that Good Fortune, she started talking about the fact that you need to slow down and take your moments. And I'd had a teacher years ago say to me, it's like you want to be a moving target. It's like you're afraid of actually being measured. You're just always zooming around through these scenes, and it might help you to like slow down. And she said, you must take your moments. And I'm thinking, well, gosh, okay, what does that mean? And, I guess I'll try to look for places that I can shut up in the middle of these scenes. And of course, what it really means is, you know, to actually practice moments of revelation, which is one of the key things that an actor can learn how to do, or practice moments of surprise, you know, not being so on top of everything, you know, to be more in a process of discovery. I was thinking about it this last year in the last episode of Dark Winds. I had a moment in a hospital where the writing was exquisite, where a man talks about the singular event of his life, the event that pivoted his sense of who he was in the world, where a burden was put on him that he can never escape. And there was a moment in this exquisite retelling of that evening, the language of it so evocative and clear, brilliant, brilliant writing. And I basically was in the backyard of this place where this tragedy happened. And I got so deep into seeing it that I was able to just stop and see the various details that mattered of it, a man, a tree, a noose hanging down, and I just stopped, and they too, so grateful that they just let that play, and later when I saw it, I thought, wow, this is a measure of how far I've finally come in being willing to take my moments, you know, to actually stop in the middle of a really intense scene, and see nothing, do nothing, see internally, but really do nothing while I saw, and trusting that the truth of it and the power of it would see us through it. And it did.
It kind of reminds me of when people talk about baseball and they say the secret to hitting the fastball is to see it coming in slowly. And it seems like as you're telling me this story, I'm thinking, as you know, decades into your career, you, I think, what you're saying is you're able to see these roles come in at you, not as a fastball, but, you know, nice and slowly, and focus on it and really just see all the nuances that maybe, you know, early in a career, you just, you know, tap dancing from one to another. But it must be nice to have that perspective now to be able to see the whole picture.
That's a beautiful metaphor. And just as in baseball, you know, the capacity to relax, you know, even though there's reason to think that you're under terrible pressure, if you want to think about it, but the capacity to relax, you know, to actually, you know, slow it down. And I think that I've noticed, you know, obviously at the end of this trend toward relaxation, you just evaporate and they dig a hole and stick you in the ground. But at the point that I'm at now, I realize that I don't get anxious anymore when I work, and why is that? And I think it's just because I just don't have the energy to devote to that. I mean, everything I've got now is, it needs to be put to work servicing the text, the narrative, the point of the scene. There's so much to be serviced, and the longer you're in the game, the more you understand the places you can go to find the different things in it. And once you see the job in its full scope and are willing to address as much as you possibly can, you find that you don't have a lot of juice left to be worried about it. You just have to keep doing it.
It makes me think about 1972 and the Cowboys, which I've been watching a lot of clips of lately. And I've watched some of your panels where you come back with the members of the cast, you know, decades later. Mm. I can't imagine what it must have been like for you at that time to be in a movie like that and stand in front of John Wayne and interact with someone like that. The anxiousness must have been near paralyzing. I can't imagine what it was like for you.
Yeah, that's what it was. I mean, I've been that way. I felt the same way around Meryl Streep. It's like, what am I going to say? Now we're done with the rehearsal. Are we supposed to talk? Now, what am I going to say? You know, I had a few things I could talk about with the Duke. You know, I mentioned that I know that he had a Hispanic wife, and I knew that there was something about Glendale. I can't remember. It was a part of L.A. where he had some. He might have gone to Glendale College before he went to Glendale High School before we went to USC, something about Glendale. So I was able to talk about, you know, when I ran cross country in high school, we ran at Glendale Park, and there was a tree that we would get sick on if the smog was too bad that day after the race, and, you know, weird things like that, you know. And John Wayne is looking at me like, but to his credit, he understood that, you know, it costed me a lot to talk to him. I mean, I was so in awe of him, and I didn't really know how to hide it. And, you know, it almost doesn't seem appropriate to try to hide it. I heard Bobby Carradine had a whole other thing with him. Bobby Carradine, sort of gave him a line reading, you know, when he told him up and when he said, you got to go back up on the fence. He had a suggestion about better syntax of how to say that line. And I'm thinking to myself, what? You know, I mean, I don't know how you get the nerve to do that. But then, you know, one of the differences between Bobby and me is that Bobby comes from a long line of acting royalty. And he feels more, you know, more at home in it than I will ever feel, I think.
I want to fast forward to the 80s. Santa Barbara, obviously, is such a iconic role for you. I heard you had to be talked into doing it, though. Mm.
Yeah, I didn't have a history of watching soaps. I had this, I don't know where it came from, but I had this memory one day of walking by the TV. It might have been that Leslie was watching a show. I'm not sure. It might have been way before I even met Leslie, but I remember walking by the TV and seeing a soap and seeing an actress doing a scene. And at the end of the scene was over and the camera lingered on her and lingered and lingered and lingered. And you watch this actor. And I realize now that what she was doing was just filling time. you know, I remember that one of my teachers, he got a gig on one of them when they were still being done live. And he said, he's on camera and he's, you know, just there to play one day. And he's coming to the end of a scene and the stage manager runs up behind the camera and goes like, stretch it. And the poor guy is, you know, trying to just remember his lines. And now he's got some stranger and they're like with big giant scared eyes saying, make it longer. So I think maybe that's what was happening to that woman and the organ music, the woman I saw and the organ music swells. And you watch this actress who done a perfectly good job in the scene now just start to pull faces to try to, you know, find something dignified to do at the end of it. And I just thought, oh, that's a fate. That's a fate I don't want to ever have any part of. So, yeah, I didn't want to do it. And Leslie, in her wisdom, my wife, Leslie, in her wisdom, said, well, you know, I've watched them and I really like them. The good ones are good and the bad ones are not so good, but the good ones are really good. And I remember when I got the audition, I couldn't imagine finding a way to get through the scene. It was just a language that I didn't understand. I didn't know how to play that way. And Leslie said, well, why don't you rewrite it? And so I did. And that gave me a tremendous advantage, I think, because of all the people. There was 30 people in the room, little room at NBC. And I remember, I had gone to a park down the street on Olive Avenue in Burbank. And I'd sat under a big oak tree. I can still see that tree when I drive down that street. And I had a yellow legal pad and I just started writing. And I wrote out a version and redone it and redid it. And I ended up with a version of it that I thought I could play. You know, it just took out the stuff that I didn't know what to do with and sort of put in stuff I felt comfortable with. And I went to the audition and the casting director's associate, her name was Carol Nicholas Coster, remembered her last name and reminded me of it last year before he passed, but I still don't hold it. But Dudley, I think, Carol Dudley. And God, I love Nick Coster. But you know, I'm sitting there. I remember I'm sitting next to my pal Richard with whom I'm competing constantly my whole life. And Carol says, how you doing, eh? And I said, you know, I'm having trouble, you know, which is the truth. I really couldn't solve it. I just don't know what to do with it. You know, and I just struggled and struggled and I sort of gave up. I just couldn't do it, but I could do this. And I gave her my yellow legal pad and she just, oh, we could do that. And she basically took that. I'd memorized it, and she took it into the room where they were taping the auditions. And she showed off camera, and read. I think it was Santana, the character Santana. She read Santana off camera for me in the words that I'd put together. So it gave me a tremendous advantage.
I've seen so many clips. There's so many clips of it on YouTube. So many clips, in fact, that I started having nightmares that I'm appearing on stage and I don't remember my lines, and that I've got them completely memorized. And then I go on stage, and 2 minutes before I go on stage, the nightmare is it's all out of my mind. If you want me to, I can improvise, or we can just cancel the show.
Oh God!
And I honest to God, blame it on soap opera clips. It must have been, I can't even imagine. I can't wrap my head around how difficult it would be to digest the amount of dialogue you had to memorize on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
Daily basis.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. And I think if I'd have known, I might've stuck to my first answer, which was no, I can't do it. It's like anything else. If you can find a way, if you can, you know, devise a strategy and hold on to it, chances are something good will happen. Cause you know, it literally is the same as, you know, if you want to run a distance, you have to train to run. And if you want to, you know, lift a weight, you have to train to do that. If you want to hit a baseball, you have to train to do that. You know, it's like, if you do the work of figuring out a way to cover the processing challenges, then you can find a way. And the beautiful thing that I didn't see coming was that by meeting that challenge, a whole lot of other things in my life improved. I learned how to manage time and energy way, way better than I had ever previously been able to do. And, you know, that makes everything better. That, you know, and your whole day to life is streamlined and improved when you can actually be more efficient like that. And if that's the key to being to covering, is you have to be efficient. You have to learn to identify the parts in the script that are the ones that are going to kill you, and rather than try to, you know, attack the entire thing and master the whole thing in one fell swoop, you have to figure the places where you're going to fall apart, and then work to shore them up, trusting that the places that come easier will still be easy when you get there. And generally, that's what proved to be the truth about it.
I think one of the things too that people love about Santa Barbara, you mentioned Nick Coster earlier, and man, I was such a fan of his. I didn't know he was on Santa Barbara. I was watching the movie MacArthur one day, and Melissa walked in and goes, "That's Nick Coster from Santa Barbara." And I was like, "Really? Yeah. You know how many movies?" I was like, "He's in All the President's Men. He's legendary." It's like, he must. And then you had Robin Wright,
right,
who, you know, I guess, you know, went on to do Princess Bride. It must have been satisfying to work with two people like that.
It was incredible. I don't remember what I said to her anymore, but I was walking down. We had a brand new studio. We sort of knew Studio 11 at NBC, and it was part of the reason the show was so successful, because the technology was brand new. We could shoot in candlelight, and we could whisper and be heard, because the apparatus would grab us, and the you know, it allowed us to work in intimate ways that were not available to people that were doing the you know, the old fashioned machinery where you had to flood the entire stage with light and act as if you were on stage. And it allowed that for us to happen. But anyway, we had our dressing rooms, and there was a long hallway that you'd walk down before you actually opened the double doors out into the soundstage. And I remember walking down there, going to do a scene with Robin, and just saying something to her about acknowledging that it seemed to me that she was destined for great things, that something was going to happen for her because of the quality of her work. And she was so young, you know, she was just outside. I think she had sued for emancipation before she became 18 and gone to Europe to model as maybe a 16 or 17 year old. So she had a lot of chops in the world already. And of course, Nick, I'll tell you, this is something that I just saw this casting director for the first time in years, but I was at an audition one time, and this casting director said to me, I like what you're doing with this. I don't know if you're going to be the guy that gets this, but I like what you're doing with this. She said, "You're like one of those really rarefied soap actors. You're like Nick Coster. You're like Nikki Coster. You can do anything. You know, you don't have to just be on daytime." And I'm thinking to myself, holy cow, I'm going to remember this the rest of my life and pray that she's right. Because one of my fears was, when I got offered the chance to do it, was my agent is giving up on me now. He thinks that I'm only a daytime actor, and he's going to put me into that scene where the woman has to wait for the organ music to fade out, and I'm going to be embarrassing myself. I didn't get it. But when she said that, I thought, what an incredible compliment to be compared to Nicholas Coster. And so Nicholas Coster, there you go. And he, you know, he didn't make anybody feel like, hey, I'm Nicholas Coster and you're not. You know, he was never like that. not only with his fans, he was so available to his fans always, but also with his fellow actors. You know, it's one of the reasons he was so beloved, because he did not put on airs. You know, he was there to help you. He helped me. I know I've said this enough times, it may be getting old, but he said to me one day, he said, you know, A, and he didn't say, I'm going to give you advice because I think you need it. He said, you know, when you're going to choose on how to do a scene, you can remember that it doesn't have to be what's probable. You don't have to play what's probable. As long as what you choose to play is possible, it's okay to go for it. You know, you can go for anything that's possible. You don't have to do what, you know, in a way of saying, you don't have to do what we expect will be done. So I went, okay, I'm going to hold on to that. That was a great piece of advice.
Well, you proved him right. You proved the casting director right. Because I mean, I don't have enough fingers to count how many iconic TV shows of the 80s that you appeared on. You know, Heart to Heart, Fantasy Island, Chips, Barney Miller. And then, of course, you leave Santa Barbara and you go to L.A. Law. That must have been an interesting transition to go from a show where you helped build the show to a show that had, you know, already had a pretty good, strong track record with, you know, its fans.
Yeah, yeah. I loved it. It was a big change in rhythm and very challenging from the point of view that by the end of Santa Barbara, you know, having been there 8.5 years and having gained a lot of trust in the process. I mean, I parlayed the fact that I rewrote my audition into a lot of leeway. And it wasn't just me. We had a lot of actors that did a lot of editing and remedial kind of approaches to the writing. You know, it just, the writing was phenomenal on Santa Barbara, but it's still a big committee of people that's processing this beast that has to be fed constantly. And sometimes from the course of one day to another, you'll find things in the writing that you just can't square with the subtext that you've now developed. After a while, you have so much subtext about what this character is thinking to get through all of these challenges that, you know, you depend on that subtext, on that history that really is sort of only exists between your ears. So sometimes you have to like make changes just to stay inside the cocoon of this character. And then you go to L.A. Law, a show like L.A. Law, where they were absolutely sticklers for, they wanted you to say the script as written down to the punctuation. They wanted the rhythms of the commas in it. And, you know, okay. And of course, the writing is very good, but also the writing was coming at you late sometimes. It was not uncommon to get the script at your door pretty late the night before. At the worst, I think, was, you know, approaching 11 o'clock the night before. You got to come up early in the morning and be ready to do it word perfect. And that was really hard, having been able to act for years with a lot of leeway about how I'm going to get through these scenes. And suddenly, no, you're not. You have no leeway. You're going to say exactly this. And of course, they're lawyers, so they talk in a certain way and stuff. It was a big challenge.
I can't leave the 80s without talking about Pow Wow Highway, which I just saw for the first time last night, like 12 hours ago I saw it.
Oh my gosh.
Marilyn's DVD, we have it. And I got to watch this before I talk to A. And I'm like, okay, I think I have an idea. I'd seen the trailers and a couple of clips. I had an idea for what it was. But man, that movie blows me away. It is like the ultimate road trip from Montana to Santa Fe. You know, Gary Farmer is incredible. The soundtrack's amazing. The two of you as, you know, as buddies on this, you know, epic journey. It's one of those movies that you gotta be super proud of. I know I was just, I had to keep pausing it and telling Melissa, this is incredible. This is how I've never heard about this before. Like, this is incredible.
That's so good, man. I can't believe I got to do that. I think first off, I should say, I think Gary Farmer is one of the best actors I've ever worked with. I mean, when you're on the stage with someone and you're working really close with them, like to be to be standing literally a few feet away from Meryl Streep, spend a day doing that and just watch that, you know, you gain a glimpse into a world that's so rarefied, it's hard to put a value on it. And Gary's like that, you know. He does things in the course of going through the work that are so deep, so true, so so kind of fluid. You know, he has like this this quicksilver capacity to get an impulse and go with it. I mean, I don't know if you ever saw it. He did an episode of Longmire where he played a contrary, you know, a guy who does opposites. And Aaron was his character's name. And he, there was a scene under a freeway underpass, you know, under a part of a freeway where he was homeless, living in his lair down there. And Walt and Henry Standing Bear went down there to confront him because it seemed like maybe he'd done something really bad. And he, in that scene, sort of slipped between hysterically laughing and crying repeatedly and did physical stuff, jumping around there and threatening Henry and Lou Diamond Phillips. And I mean, it was breathtaking. And later he came and did another one where he came into a political meeting, you know, with six shooters and cap guns and came running down the aisle, like trying to scare the people to death and stuff. Just, you know, Brando-esque level of power. And so to get to watch him was astonishing. So good. The kind of thing that's so good that you want to make sure that you're not turning into too much of a fan doing the work. You know, you want to filter your amazement through your character, not through your own sense of values. I don't want people to see that I can't believe what I'm seeing. I want them to think that it's Buddy who's impressed, you know, my character. But I think that the film, you know, they were trying to get it made for 10 years, you know, one thing that until recently, you know, nobody wanted to hear stories about Indians that were actually, you know, about real people Indians. But, you know, we wanted to, you know, they're either the noble savage or the savage, you know. It's like, don't be talking about, you know, these political aspects of it. But of course, in truth, that's what you got. And they developed this thing. Jonathan Wax, who was the director, had been a radical in South Africa. You know, his politics aligned very much with the politics of Powell Highway. And after 10 years in Development Hill, trying to get the thing off the ground, getting anybody interested, they found a way to get it to George Harrison, the ex-Beatle, may he rest in peace. And of course, he looked at it and went, oh yeah, sure, let's do that. You bet we'll do that.
When you talk about Powwow Highway and Longmire and Dark Wind, you're seeing it gives a larger audience the chance to sort of, you know, see the story and the history of Native Americans and how they live and how they've been treated. What were the breakthrough moments in Hollywood where their stories were finally told with the respect and understanding that they deserve?
Well, you know, I think Powwow Highway was certainly among those moments. It was not mainstream at all, but the thing was that it in Indian country, it was revered. You know, Wes Studi made his debut in Powwow Highway. He was brilliant in a fairly small part, just killed it right out of the gate. And you know, so there, you know, there is like a calling card. This guy has got something going on, and of course, he went on to become this legend. And I think that one of the most beautiful things that happened was, you know, there were things like Into the West, you know, got into some stuff like that, but there were the advent of streaming, the miracle of what Netflix did It's just, to this day, you look at it and you go, wow. I mean, you know, they had this idea, you know, we want to do original programming. And they put feelers out in Hollywood for people to help them. And everybody turned up their nose. It's like, you know, who do you think you are? You send DVD deals in the mailbox. You know, what do you, come on. So they went, oh, well, okay, well, no help. Well, I guess we'll have to figure out what to do on our own. And so basically they hijacked the entire business. And, you know, and because of what they, I remember when this first started to be on the horizon, they'd say things like, you know, there's going to be a lot more shows and they're going to be spread over a wider spectrum. And it's not going to just be, you know, who the big players want to, what they do. It's actually a lot of people are going to be able to do things. It's going to be niche programming. And is that word niche or niche?
I go with niche.
Niche. You know, if you want to stick your pinky in there, you say niche. but yeah, you know, suddenly, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, if there's that kind of programming, there might be room for like people like me to actually have more work. And lo and behold, it finally happened because, you know, the, like Dark Winds is a big, big hit, but it doesn't have to do the numbers that, you know, you'd had to do 20 years ago to become be considered a hit. You know, it's just, you know, it's found its audience and the people that find it love it so much and talk it up that it's growing the audience. The audience grew beautifully during the entire 2-season run, and we're up for a third season coming. So, you know, I think streaming was the beginning of it.
So season 3 for Dark Wind is coming up. What else are you working on?
Well, I have a role on a show called Blue Ridge that shoots in North Carolina that stars Jonathan Schaech. And I just got to get a sneak peek at the preview trailer for that. And it looks wonderful. Probably going to come out in spring. I did a movie with Bailey Chase from Longmire called Farhaven that had a brief run this year on the Cowboy Way channel as an exclusive. But at the beginning of next year, that's going to come out in January next year. That's going to come out. And Bailey is phenomenal. It's one of those beautiful moments where you see an actor get to play a guy he was born to play, like Gary Farmer playing Filbert in Powwow Highway, you know, where they're just, okay, this part was designed to be played by this guy and he got it. So that's a great thing. And then I'm in Avatar, The Last Airbender, the Netflix reboot of that, which is coming out, I think, February 22nd. And, you know, that was an exquisite experience. I was not aware of that show, the anime, how beloved it was. My children all knew. And I know some friends of mine, you know, that I'm, or my contemporaries, watched it with their kids when it was in the original marketplace and loved it. And I think they just did a phenomenal job of putting this thing together.
Here at Stuck in the 80s, we like to think of the podcast as a time machine. And as such, I can grant you a seat on the so-called podcast time machine to go back and relive a moment from your past or catch an event you missed, or even give yourself, a younger version of yourself, some good advice. If I give you that seat on the time machine, where would you go back to and what would you do?
Oh my God. Yeah, you're right. I should have held this as a prompt. I think if I could go back in time, I would be a little more serious about my role as a father. I'm very much responsible about it. You know, I think by and large, I've been a good father. But as I've gotten older, I realized that I could have been a better father. I think the thing that most, you know, I'm a very, very optimistic person, and I tend to want to get to the word yes as often as I can, even all my fear about Santa Barbara notwithstanding. I really want to get to yes I remember working with Michael Caine 40 years ago and asking him about his career. And he said, you know, I try to say yes. I just say yes, even if it looks like it could be a train wreck. You know, if they want me to come and play, I say yes. And I think 16 years later, he got the Cider House Rules and won his Oscar. But, you know, saying yes. And I think of that, the great, you know, John Patrick Shanley, the playwright, the guy who wrote Doubt and Moonstruck and Savage and Limbo and these incredible plays, that some of which became movies. You know, he talks about, he wrote a preface to Doubt where he says, you know, we can't know, you know, we have to learn to embrace uncertainty. You know, conviction is a resting place. I've heard this described as belief is the death of thought. And when you come across religious fanaticism, you go, yeah, I think that could be true. Belief is the death of thought. But if you admit that you don't know, then you're likely to actually be more alert to what is really going on, to be reading the unfolding moments of any given situation or time you're passing through. And I try so hard to stay comfortable with uncertainty. Being an actor is good for that, because it's nothing but uncertainty. You're just constantly have no idea what you're going to do next. But if anything, but the thing is that in keeping this positive attitude and trying to find yes and stuff, yes, yes, yes. Sometimes, you know, my kids have come to me and said, what do you think I should do? You know, I have this thing in front of me, and I will just, without thinking twice, just go to, I think you should try to find a way to say yes. And then years later, sometimes saying yes was really maybe not the better option. And you won't know for a long time sometimes. And I worry that I've just sort of defaulted to my knee-jerk, childlike actors staying in touch with their inner child. I've been real good at that. Just not taking the possibility of difficulty as seriously as I might have. And I, if I had to do anything over again, I think I would find a way to develop that part of myself a little better, so that when I was asked for advice from my kids, I could give a more fulsome picture of what the options and the possibilities were, rather than just default to the optimistic choice, you know, just say yes. I can't believe I'm actually saying this to you, Steve, but this week I've been feeling it.
Of all the times I've asked that question, that is the most thoughtful response.
I appreciate you asking the question. It's a good question. I think as we get older, you know, we start to have to, you know, whether you want to or not, you know, you just fall into the realm of seeing what's gone before with more acute eyes, I think.
Thanks so much for your time. This has been an amazing chat.
I so appreciate you and this show, man. It's really cool. And I think your own wisdom in the journey is, you wear it on your sleeve, and I really admire it.
There he is, A. Martinez. That was a great hour.
He's probably one of the most reflective, articulate people I've ever known. And Marcy Walker was actually quoted as saying that he's the most sensitive, caring person she's ever worked with. And wow. I think you can really hear that in the interview. And, you know, he talks about Jackson Brown. He shared a story with me that I think is very typical of who he is. He was backstage at a Jackson Brown concert, itching for the opportunity to talk to his hero. A Santa Barbara fan cornered A, and instead of cutting off this person so he could go and meet his hero, he just stood there and continued talking to her, because that's who he is.
Yeah. If you really want to get a chance to see him really do his magic, there's a 1980s movie called Powwow Highway, and it was an independent flick. Mm-hmm. Very hard to find. It's not streaming. You'd have to like probably find a copy of a DVD on eBay, but Melissa and I watched it. I think it was the night before I talked to A. And it was just a really fantastic kind of like a Midnight Run story. Mm-hmm. With A and Gary Farmer starring as two Native Americans, you know, crossing the country on a mission to save his sister. But just a fantastic, I thought, answer he had as well to the podcast time machine. That's a question that I think trips people up, and I couldn't have imagined his answer to that.
Well, again, I think it just exemplifies who he is, because A is someone that is always striving to do better and always, you know, looking inwardly. And it's something that even back as a 14-year-old, when I met him the first time and the first few times that we shared a meal together, I was so struck by that, you know, here was someone who had achieved so much success and received so many accolades and so much love from the fans. And he was still so humble, so gracious, always with a real strong appetite to just keep learning and keep growing as a human being and as an actor.
And these days you can also find him, I think, the TV show Avatar: The Last Airbender.
Mm-hmm.
Just mm-hmm. started on Netflix, and A's got a spot in that. It's also pretty cool that we're just now releasing this podcast with A. He starts in a new show called Blue Ridge, which is on the Cowboy Way channel, premieres April 7th. It was shot in around Charlotte, North Carolina. Really sounds like an interesting story of heart, action, justice-driven storytelling, you know, the sort of stuff that he really excels at.
He'll be on the second season of Dark Winds, which is streaming on AMC Plus, Apple TV, and Prime. He recently filmed a guest spot on ABC's The Rookie, which reunites him with Nathan Fillion, who he worked with on Castle many years ago. And on Netflix, you can also still enjoy his great work as Jacob Nighthorse on Longmire. So he's busy and having, you know, quite a renaissance right now in terms of his TV and movie work. And it couldn't happen to a more deserving person.
It's his time.
Yep, it sure is.
You know what else it's time for?
Time for you to make dinner?
Soon.
Time to walk the dog?
Well, yes, but that's not what I meant.
Oh, time for the Seggies. TV party tonight! TV
party tonight! TV party tonight! Hey, it's time for TV party tonight. We will play a snippet of a theme song from an 80s TV show. If you get it right, you're entered into the drawing for a postal-friendly bottle opener. Brad, who would normally be on the show, is in New York City right now. And so we'll see how many shows he shows up for in the next couple of weeks, because he's super, super engaged in his job. But so anyone who does win a postal-friendly bottle opener right now, it may be a couple months before you get one. That's all I'm saying. So be patient. But in the meantime, from episode 694, here was the mystery theme song. That's Simon and Simon. This was a trivia question on the 80s cruise this year, I think, wasn't it? It was your idea.
Yes. Yes. Well, thank you very much. It was actually a category that I came up with on famous duos of the 80s on television. Yeah. So I think we also had Cagney and Lacey in there, Hardcastle and McCormick, some of the classic buddy shows of the era.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what the other ones. We had one for every day.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm whiffing at it right now. It's been like just over a month since that. So I've kind of turned my attention to 2025. Anyway, Simon and Simon ran from 1981 to 1989 on CBS, starred Gerald McRaney and Jameson Parker as two brothers who operate a two-person detective agency in San Diego. A lot of people remember it for the crossover episode they had with Magnum PI. And there was also a reunion movie in 1995 called Simon and Simon in Trouble Again. I miss that as well.
Yeah, I miss that too. We'll have to add that to our watch list.
Oh, geez. What we, last night we were watching Moonlighting?
Moonlighting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. God, still just as good all these years later.
There's some TV shows that don't age. we're watching... What are we watching right now? We're watching Moonlighting. We're also like alternating between Dynasty.
Yes, and believe it or not, folks, Spearsy willingly watched, was it two episodes, three episodes now of the original Dynasty, not the train wreck remake from a few years back. Let's just clarify, that was terrible.
We made it, I think, 10 minutes into that episode, and we're like, nope.
Nope.
We've turned Dynasty into a drinking game, though. So
Yes.
every time they show footage of the front gate at the Carrington estate, we have to
Which,
drink.
let's just be clear, has the initials of Mr. Carrington on it, so we know we're going into his palatial estate.
Yeah. So every time they show it, you have to take a drink. And I'm telling you right now, you better really stock up on the alcohol before you play this game with us, because it's like a joke how often they show it. Like, okay, we get it.
I think you said that we didn't have enough booze in the house to continue.
Yes, we have plenty of booze in the house, but we'll see. I have booze for tonight if we want to play again. But in the meantime, we have some winners. Actually, I guess a lot of people got this one right. I wish Brad was here to read these.
I can take a crack at it.
Okay, have fun.
Winners include, I've always wanted to say that, Jeff in Asheville, Jay Swash in Davenport, Anonymous Dave, Warren in Sydney, Carlos M. Hernandez, Blue Fest in San Diego, Gerald from Boston, Brian in Columbus, Dave's not here, Jonathan in Grovetown, Georgia, Cincinnati Joe, Real Actor Bob, aka Beach Fit Rob, Dave De La Dirt, Larry in Maryland, Anastasia in Colorado, Commodore 64 Will, Fetch in Evansville, Todd in Minnesota, Lito in Austin, Carlos from Slippery Rock, Alejandro Sticks Cardoso Solis from Tijuana, Mexico, Jeff 808 Man Pierce, Jonathan Thompson and Daphne, Peter Ryan in Montreal, Jeremy Carter, Chad in Hollister, Richard the Big Bunny, John Ross from Charlotte, North Carolina, Jeremy, who shot J.R. Radwin, John DeMacus, Alan Titus, Chase Squires, and the tromboner.
The tromboner, everyone's favorite. Okay, you want to spin the wheel, find out who takes home the postal-friendly bottle opener?
Oh, yes, please. Okay.
One, two, three. We need to find a drinking game to play with moonlighting, but haven't figured that one out yet.
No, we could do it every time there's a limerick that Miss DePesto says when she answers the phone.
That would work. That would work. Looks like it's going to land on Jonathan in Grovetown, Georgia. So, Jonathan, send us your snail mail address, and I will pass it on to Brad, and Brad will. I think he's heading home in a couple weeks, maybe. So maybe he'll send some out. In the meantime, pay attention. Here is this week's mystery TV theme song. If you know it, email us at podcast@sit80s.com and tune in a few weeks to find out if you're a winner. We'll be right back after this commercial break.
Love lesson number six, how to make up after a quarrel.
I'm sorry. I know I can take your mind off it if you give me a chance.
You can try.
Oh, there we go. We got a smile.
Brush up on your romance with Santa Barbara, weekdays.
And we're back. We have time to play one last Seggy. Are you ready for it?
Actually, I have a PPTMN for you. You always
Okay.
talk on the show about how you and Brad didn't watch a ton of TV in the 80s, but I know for a fact you watched your fair share. What shows did you actually watch?
That's a fair question. Brad's not here to answer, so let's see. I Love Boat and Fantasy Island, that was required viewing.
For me too.
Head of the class. There was a TV show on Showtime back then called The Paper Chase. It was based on the movie, which came out in the early 70s, I think. And then it turned it into a TV series that was on regular TV. It lasted 1 year. And then Showtime picked it up and ran the rest of the season. So The Paper Chase, about people at law school in Harvard, that was my favorite show. A Different
Which I know
World.
since you have several DVDs of it.
I know. Well, what's funny is I bought all those. And from some like sketchy store online. And what they really sent me was it's a bunch of episodes of Little House on the Prairie.
One of your other favorite shows.
Yeah, I did watch that, but that was more 70s. Buck Rogers in the 25th Century. Family Ties, Moonlighting for sure. What about you?
Family Ties, Moonlighting, Cheers, loved Cheers, Give Me a Break, Facts of Life, Happy Days, Different Strokes. We were talking about buddy shows before. There was one called Kate and Allie about two single moms, Jane Curtin and
that was the one. That was the other one we had.
That was the other one, Kate and Allie. Yeah.
Yeah, that we had for trivia. Jesus. Mm-hmm. Totally forgot about that one. What other soaps did you watch besides Santa Barbara?
Oh my gosh. At one time or another, well, Days of Our Lives and General Hospital were my other two big ones, but I also tuned in at various points to, now I'm really going to date myself, Search for Tomorrow, Another World, a short-lived one called Generations. Is that it? Yeah, I think that's it. I was pretty much in the Santa Barbara NBC wheelhouse. And for me, Santa Barbara was far and away my favorite.
I have probably seen, I don't know how many hours of YouTube clips of Santa Barbara at this point. I mean, easily, probably, I don't know, years. It feels like, but I enjoy it. I get it. I understand the appeal, and it's fun to see some of these actors that would go on. You know, I think Nick Coster is one of my favorite actors, and he had a regular spot on Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm.
Robin Wright. They mentioned, yeah.
Wow, yeah. So a lot of great stuff comes out of soaps. I hope you enjoyed our interview with A. Martinez and got a chance to meet Mrs. Spearsy. check out Dark Winds. Check out Blue Ridge. Go back and watch Longmire on Netflix. Ugh,
he is absolutely brilliant in that show. And I think outside of Santa Barbara, that's his, you know, longest series role. And he just loved it and became very close with the cast and the crew. And it's a really beloved show. And he plays a truly interesting character in it.
Yeah. And by all means, check out Avatar, The Last Airbender. Definitely worth a deep dive on this amazing actor and his work. Hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next week with hopefully our review of the new Ghostbusters movie. In the meantime, Mrs. Spears and I remain here, hopelessly stuck in the 80s.
Stuck in the 80s is now on Patreon. If you'd like to support the show, go to patreon.com/stuckinthe80s podcast. Special thanks to Check Battery Daily for our theme music, and thanks for listening.